This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The plot reads like an action film. Two brothers ship out to Vietnam to serve in the same infantry unit. They each save each other's life. They live to tell the story. All that one needs is a love interest. This one happens to be a true story, though. The brothers' names could be familiar to you. They are Tom and Chuck Hagel. Chuck Hagel went on to be a senator and then Secretary of Defense under President Barack Obama. My guest today has written a book about the Hagel brothers' experiences. Daniel Bolger is a retired Army general, a history professor at North Carolina State University, and the author of Our Year of War, Two Brothers, Vietnam, and a Nation Divided. Daniel Bolger, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be here.
Incredible story. Tell us about this, because these brothers, they came to your attention, actually, when you started talking to them.
Yeah. I as you mentioned, I served in the U.S. Army, and I actually got to hear from then-Senator Chuck Hagel of the state of Nebraska. He came to speak to our War College class, and in his introduction, he just mentioned it in the most offhanded way you can imagine. Oh, yeah, when I was serving in Vietnam with my brother, we were in the same rifle platoon. And I remember turning to the Army guy next to me, and I said, that can't be right. We don't do that anymore. We stopped doing that after World War II. It was right, and it turned out I later got to work with Secretary of Defense Hagel, got to meet his brother Tom, and began to find out about the absolutely amazing story these two guys experienced in Vietnam.
And how was it that they did serve in the same unit?
Well, what I did remember in the back of my mind from World War II was true, and that was you can't assign brothers or sisters or any immediate family members together against their will. So you can't just give them an order and say, okay, you're going to serve with your brother in this platoon. That had been done in some earlier wars, and of course, the results are tragic when you lose them all together. But if you volunteer, that's a different story. The Hagel brothers both volunteered for the draft. Then they both volunteered for the infantry. They both volunteered for Vietnam, and when they got to Vietnam, within a few weeks of each other, they volunteered to serve together in the same rifle platoon, and that was how they ended up together. I think their dad had died a few years before. He was a World War II veteran, but he had raised Chuck and Tom and their two younger brothers to believe that if your country called you, you went, and they felt like the best way to go was together.
Now, this would be a good enough story all by itself with just that, but the fact is Chuck thought this was the right war to fight. His brother Tom didn't. He didn't agree at all that we should be there.
Yeah, politically, they were on totally different ends of the spectrum. They've come together a lot in later life. I think maturity will do that for you. You sort of realize each side has something to offer. But as young guys, Chuck and most of his family, they came from Nebraska. Then and now, still a pretty conservative farm belt state, and Tom was always a little bit of the family rebel. He was born the day that Harry Truman defeated Thomas Dewey in one of the greatest upsets in American presidential elections. So the joke in the family was that Tom was born a liberal Democrat and he stayed one his whole life.
But they both serve, and it is they're infantry, they're riflemen, right? They're on point. So tell us more about what the duty that they saw, because I think one of the other things this book does, not only tell that dramatic story, but it also shines a light on the nuts and bolts of fighting this war in Vietnam.
Well, I think we should keep in mind that fighting in Vietnam, fighting in any modern war, but Vietnam certainly is very, very taxing and difficult. If there was no enemy there, just moving through the thick undergrowth of the jungle, they fought most of their battles either just east of Saigon in the jungle and rubber plantations there, and then the second part of their tour, they're in the Mekong Delta down in the swamps and jungles there. So Chuck and Tom were two of the sharpest soldiers in the unit because they were brothers. They'd gone hunting together when they were young men back in Nebraska. They were used to working together, and they volunteered to be the point team for their platoon. And what that means in sort of the most simple terms is they were the lead element of the platoon. One guy would have a machete, a big knife, and he'd be chopping away the undergrowth. The other guy behind him would have a map and a compass and be charting the direction of the platoon. Again, no global positioning system, no mapping like that. You had to do it the old-fashioned way by a compass azimuth and then keeping track your pace. And of course, the whole time they had to be looking out for booby traps, right. They had to be looking out for landmines, tripwires, and enemy activity. When the platoon made contact with the Viet Cong, It was often the Hagel brothers who first saw him and first engaged the enemy.
Yeah, you talked about the fact that you would make the decision to take the path of greatest resistance because that was the safest.
Yeah, it's sort of counterintuitive. If you or I or anybody was out walking in the woods, we'd want to go on a trail so we didn't get all beat up and everything. But that's the exact place you wouldn't want to go in Vietnam because the enemy had those outposted and booby-trapped and covered with landmines. So the soldiers would actually prefer to go through very thick undergrowth, knowing that the Viet Cong wouldn't outpost those areas. And that allowed them, in some cases, to sneak up on the enemy undetected.
But there was at least one case that you record in the book where they did come across a booby trap, and therein lies the story as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, a very rough day they had near one of the rubber plantations east of Saigon, not in the plantation itself, but just outside in the undergrowth. And Chuck and Tom were leading, and it had come to a point where they were going to the commander was going to give them a break. He was going to let them rotate back off. And as they pulled off and two other guys took over, those other guys hit the wire of a very large buried explosive. Might have even been a U.S. bomb that hadn't gone off that the enemy had re-rigged. And this thing caused tremendous devastation, killed one soldier outright, wounded about a dozen others, blew them all back. Chuck and Tom both blown back on their backs. Chuck had fragments all through his chest and you know, underneath your rib cage or your lungs. And so every time he breathed, you could see blood bubbling up. That's some kind of a lung wound, and that was pretty obvious. When Tom woke up, his arm was all bloody and chopped up, but he saw that his brother was laying there, not looking too good. And, of course, the enemy opened fire with rifles and machine guns. So, you know, Tom grabbed his brother, pulled him back, got him out of the line of fire, got a bandage on his chest, pressed down, you know, got things under control. At the same time, he had to take care of his own wounds, and Chuck sort of came to. And you'd think that the two of them at that point would be evacuated. The amazing thing is they weren't the two most heavily wounded people there. There were people missing limbs. The one soldier, as I mentioned, was dead. And so after a very difficult helicopter extraction using a winch, sending a line down through the jungle and sending people up in a basket, they had to move the platoon and the company back out to their fire base. Company commander, the captain, turned to Chuck and Tom and said, "I know you guys are shot up, beat up, wounded, but you're the only guys I can trust. Can you get us back before it gets dark and the Viet Cong close in on us?" So there they were, wounded, not feeling the best by any means, and they took over again and led the company file out of there. And just as they were turning, it was just starting to get dark, Chuck was in the lead, and he's hacking away with the machete and all that, and Tom grabbed him. He didn't say a word. He just grabbed his shoulder real hard and pointed ahead of him. And what do they see but barely evident, a little bit of fishing line. And at the end of that fishing line was a hand grenade in a can. And if Chuck had hit that line, that grenade would have popped out, pin come out, and they would have both been blown away. So in that regard.
And they disarmed that and got around it. So it also points to, I mean, once you're in the field of battle, again, you can talk about whether or not we as Americans, and we do and should exercise the right to push back if we believe that this endeavor is not the right thing. But once you're in the theater of war together, then it's all about solidarity within that theater.
It absolutely is. I mean, we talk about, you know, brothers and sisters in a unit fighting in a war. Tom and Chuck were literally two brothers fighting in the war, and their political views were strongly held then and now. But once they got into the jungle of Vietnam, it was all about helping keep people alive.
You also took a look at the way the strategy and some of the ways in which the war was conducted. Part of it was, you know, in previous wars and in wars since, people would serve for the duration of the war, certainly World War II. That was not the case in Vietnam, and it caused some real trouble as the war wore on.
It did. I think when the war started, we didn't really realize how long or how intense the war would be. And the two ideas were sort of in conflict with each other. The World War II generation, that by Vietnam, 20 years later after World War II, these are the generals and the colonels. They're the senior guys. And so they thought the war was not that high intensity compared to what they faced against the Germans and Japanese in World War II. And they said, well, we'll rotate people in and out. We've got a drafty army. We'll let them serve 1 year. And then when the year was over, a person could go home. Obviously, if you got hurt or sick or something, you might go home earlier. But that was the plan. And the thought was by doing that, it would give everybody something to look forward to, and they could sustain a war effort over many, many years. In their view, low intensity. Well, of course, it's easy to say low intensity if you're sitting in an air-conditioned headquarters in Saigon. It's not so low intensity when you're not getting shot at in the jungle. And, of course, people were getting killed. People were getting wounded. And the other thing that happened is when you move people in year after year, you start the war the first year in 1965 with all your experienced sergeants, all your experienced officers. Many of them had served in World War II and Korea. They might have been advisors earlier in Vietnam. Those guys are all there for the first year. By the second year, they rotate out. And now you bring in a crew from Europe and from the United States that may still have some combat experience, but they're not immediately experienced. By the third year, by the time Chuck and Tom get there, there's nobody with any real experience. And so Chuck and Tom, although very young draftees who started as privates, they were sergeants by the summer of their year in Vietnam, about halfway through.
Yeah, and that was the attrition of NCOs is something that you really put a finger on. So did but Chuck ended up outranking his brother, even though they were both sergeants.
Well, he did, because you know in the great ways of the military, if two people have the exact same name and they're otherwise equal, they go alphabetical order of their first names, and C comes before T, so Chuck would outrank Tom.
Other interesting thing is these guys are infantry, but this particular unit had armor personnel characters, although carriers. Though I guess I should put armor in quotes.
Yeah, what they were equipped with the M113 armor personnel carrier, a vehicle design that is still in use in our military today. You can find them still in the Army, although it's no longer considered a frontline vehicle. This thing to you or I would look like a delivery van like UPS or FedEx might use, but instead of wheels at the bottom, it had treads, same general design, and in the back where the packages would be, the soldiers would ride. They'd have a guy up top of the machine gun and a driver in front. And you mentioned armored in quotes because the armor was very lightweight, so you could pick it up with a big helicopter, you could put it in a landing craft and land it on a beach, you could even drop it with a big parachute. But it also meant the armor was made out of aluminum. So it would stop bullets. It would stop small rifle bullets. But a large machine gun bullet, and especially an explosive warhead like a rocket-propelled grenade, would not only go through it, it could actually set the aluminum on fire. Aluminum will burn.
Talking today to author and our retired Army General Daniel Bolger about his new book, Our Year of War, Two Brothers, Vietnam, and a Nation Divided. And that conversation is right here on The State of Things. So after the war, you talked about the fact that these days, as they mature, they're coming a little bit closer to each other in their ideas. But what about in the immediate aftermath?
Well, not so immediately. You know, one of the things you mentioned quite rightly is while they were over there in theater, they set aside their political and personal views about the war. When they got back, naturally, they both went to college on the GI Bill at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. And they had some time in between their studies to discuss the war. And both of them, being brothers, they knew exactly which buttons to push to get the other one going. And Chuck and Tom then are now our big guys. Chuck's a former football player. Tom's a big athletic, tall guy. And the two of them were renting a small house in North Omaha while they went to school. And more than once, they would get into such loud arguments that the neighbors would come over to see if everything was okay. And one time, it got so out of hand, they were rolling around fist fighting, smashing up the furniture in the house. The neighbor actually called the police. And the next thing you know, there's an officer of the, you know, Omaha Police Department knocking on the door. Well, Chuck and Tom at that point realized, hey, we better set aside our dispute. And they responded the way they'd been taught since they were little kids. Yes, sir.
Yes,
no, sir.
No, sir.
No problem. And their mom, after that, did the wise thing. She intervened and said, no more political discussions with you guys.
This was not only a war that was tearing apart families. We were a nation torn apart, not only over this war, but racially. And 1968 was a key year for that. And that's highlighted some of the tensions in Vietnam and at home in this book.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. Folks may remember that 50 years ago, on April 4th, 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis. And when that happened, there were ripples that went all the way into the field in Vietnam. In Chuck and Tom's rifle company, the African-American soldiers, when they got wind of it, put the word out that they weren't planning to go to the field that day. They just said, we know we got scheduled operations, but we're going to stay here on the fire base. We're not fighting this war. You know, look what's happening to our people back home. Even our most prominent civil rights leader is not safe in America. And what was interesting is what happened next. One of the officers in Chuck and Tom's company was a guy named Jerome Johnson. He was Skip Johnson, as he was nicknamed. He's a first lieutenant from Chicago, Illinois. He's an African-American guy. His neighborhood was one of the ones that was affected by the post-Dr. King death rioting. But Skip Johnson went in and talked to those African-American soldiers and said, you know, what's going on in the States is horrible. My family's involved in it just like yours is. But over here, all we've got is each other. And that enemy's going to come after us. They don't see black and white. They just see Americans, and they want to kill us. We need to work together and get through this. And then when we get home, we can deal with that. And Skip Johnson's leadership made a difference. And a postscript to that, when Chuck Hagel was Secretary of Defense, one of the first persons he invited to visit him was his old commander, then retired school teacher Skip Johnson from Chicago, who came, visited him, and when President Barack Obama got wind of that, he asked Johnson to come to the White House. So the old officer and sergeant made the trek over to the White House to meet another guy from Chicago, who by that time was the commander-in-chief.
We know what Chuck did afterwards. What about Tom? What's he doing?
Tom went to law school, and he completed his law school in Lincoln at the University of Nebraska, and then served as a public defender in Lincoln, and was involved in several key and difficult trials in that area, and then went on to teach law at the University of Dayton in Ohio. And he also serves as a judge in the municipal court in Dayton. And so he's got to work with the law pretty extensively. And I might add that Tom has always taken an active interest in people who are otherwise overlooked in our society, people who have mental challenges, people who are the elderly, folks who are not looked after because they might be minorities. Tom has always been a guy who's looked after them. And I know his brother respects him greatly for that. Chuck, of course, went into a more formal political career.
Army General, retired Army General Daniel Bolger, history professor at North Carolina State, author of Our Year of War, Two Brothers, Vietnam, and a Nation Divided. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Frank.
You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Jennifer Brooklyn, Robert Kinlaw, Angie Perrin, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jeff Hamlin on the board today with help from Al Wadarski. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.